Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have Rachel Few. Rachel and I have had an online friendship for well over a year, which is where I like to keep my friendships, online, even though she lives locally.
First time we've met in person.
I've been forced socially. You know, last year, I'll just overshare for a second, I had two goals for the year. One was to do some strength training. Anything will do. The second was to make a friend that lived within half an hour that their kids could possibly get along with mine, and I could have them over without cleaning up, and I could have a vent, possibly cry, with minimum embarrassment. That was my goal. Mm-hmm. I had you on the shortlist, top three. Did a lot of analysing, right? Did I send out one text message to one person one time? No, I did not. But I spent a lot of time thinking about it. So today...
Well, that's an honour, Jane. Thank you. Chuffed to be
I
on
couldn't
the
believe I was on... I made a list. I was like, how autistic can this friendship analogy get?
But that's the way to do it, right? Just accept that and make the list.
Anyway, my daughter found my goals and she has saw it. And then she made a list of like people that she thought I might like to be friends with. And then she's like, so we should text someone now. And I was like, I don't want to jump in too quick. Like, and we never sent the messages.
Oh, I
so
love
anyway,
that.
Anyway, we've been planning this episode for a year and we've gotten there.
Yes, here we are.
But we're going to kick off with a topic that so many people ask for, and that is in regards to overstimulation, regulation load, sensory overwhelm, and what actually helps in real life. Do you want to give a quick overview about who you are?
I sort of found myself working with neurodivergent children, actually, without even realizing it. So I guess what happened was I studied social work. I was working in schools a lot, doing counseling and a little bit of private practice. And I just noticed in the private practice, I was always attracting neurodivergent children. And I honestly thought about it so often, I'd be like, I wonder why this is. And back then, I had no idea that I was neurodivergent. And I loved working with neurodivergent children, and I would work with a lot in the schools as well. And so, yeah, when I reflect on that now, that's like, you know, about 17 years ago that I'd started working with these kids. And I learned so much through that time from working with children. But one of the big things that I noticed was, you know, they spent like 50 minutes with me, maybe once a fortnight. And it was the mums who were asking the questions, wanting to know what to do at home. And I barely had any time to spend with them. So then as time went on, I also started to work in equine assisted therapy. And I saw how the kids were getting really regulated in this time. And I was like, this is great. But again, it was like 50 minutes and then they went home. And I still didn't really get to spend any time with anyone who was going to sort of hold that and be able to shine that light in the time that they're at home. So that's when I realized I really need to work with the mums, because if the mums know the strategies, if they learn for themselves how to regulate, if they understand their own nervous system, then they can help the kids to do the same thing. And yeah, I'm loving being in that space, and I'm loving seeing the difference that it's making for families, because it seems to really have a ripple effect.
Do you get to spend more time with the mums now? Like, did you change the way you approached it?
Yeah. So I actually consciously decided to stop working with children and to solely focus on working with the neurodivergent women and neurodivergent mums. And where there's a neurodivergent mum, there's a neurodivergent family usually. And just noticed that this is where the change can happen. And also that if mum is regulated and okay, the kids will be much more likely regulated and okay.
And I'm going to try not to go down the NDIS route, but wouldn't it be great if there was some supports for the mum, because you spend your time being the taxi service and then picking them up, dropping them off, not getting that opportunity to talk to the therapist a lot of the time. And then you probably get in the car, the kids will get in, they've maybe had a great equine session, the mum would be like, We got to go get dinner. We got to go to Woolworths. Like, it's all gone real quick.
Yeah, that's it. Like, it is. It's beautiful and it's great. And I loved that work when we were there, but I was really aware of how that didn't have the flow on effect necessarily throughout the week if I didn't have the time with the mum. or the parents, but just generalizing, it tends to be the mums who are kind of more in this space. And so, yeah, it just became a focus to support them, to support the family.
So what do you, if you work predominantly now with the mums, what do you typically see? Like, is it a similar theme or flavour? You think things are improving? Where is it at on the ground?
Yeah, well, you touched on it before around kind of toing and froing to all of the different appointments, taking the kids around. It's so busy. And again, the kids are spending 50 minutes with the different therapists. And ultimately, it's leading to a burnout. It's a burnout, not just for mum, it's a burnout for the kids. It is so much, especially for kids who are at school. And if they're there 5 days a week, and then we're trying to fit in the appointments after school, there's also homeschooling mums that I talk to who are struggling to fit it in and be able to be across all of the things. And it is, it's burning people out. And I think there's more and more mums starting to question the approach and just wonder whether that is working for them. And so I'm really spending a lot of time with mums talking about, what are our priorities here? Like, there might be some of your therapies that are absolute priority. And let's look at how we build your recipe for your family that has the right ingredients. And if you're going off to, you know, this therapy and that therapy, and yet don't actually feel like you're seeing the changes that you want, how about you jump on the telehealth call for 50 minutes yourself, maybe once a week, maybe once a fortnight, and you learn about their nervous systems and about yours, and we can get to the bottom of a lot of this. It's that awareness of what's actually going on for everyone. And to be honest, for a lot of families, when there's so many appointments, we become really dysregulated.
We do. It's a good point, because we were setting up for the year, my hubby and I, and we have been blessed with three cracker teachers. Like, we've killed it. I'm so grateful to the teacher god, whoever it is. I don't know what I've done, but I managed to get three great teachers. So much to the point where I've been on the wait list to get back in with the psych that we've always seen on and off for 5 years to get a regular spot with him. And then I ended up saying to my hubby the other day, well, we've got three great teachers, so should we commit to jumping in the pool with the kids that afternoon or spending time with them playing cards or whatever it is, rather than doing the therapy appointment? Like, is time in with us more valuable if there's nothing specifically that we're looking at the moment? And we decided that we would just flag that for the moment. But I think it's a great point, because sometimes you end up doing the taxi for the therapy, but if you had have stopped, taken a break yourself or spent time with them, would that have then offset? And all that cost too. Like, if you don't have any IS, that the cost is massive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's huge. And I know, you know, there are some mums who look at this as kind of an experiment, because it is something a bit different to question and go, like, you know, because we're looking for help. We're looking desperately to see who's got some answers. And so we want to go to these appointments and get the answers, and we want to make things better. And for neurodivergent mums, typically we want to fix things. You know, we work hard at that, probably overtime for a lot of neurodivergent mums. They're working overtime to try and make things feel better for everyone in the family. And so using that energy towards prioritizing, creating this recipe that is right for the family, then is, like I said, something a bit different, but it's kind of an experiment. Let's just see how this goes. What does it feel like after one term of changing it up and actually trying something different to see if we feel more regulated and we still have help and strategies that is helping the whole family?
Side note, read out from my good friend Panda, Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia. Really recommend them. I reckon their hotline is awesome. Did an interview with the CEO late last year. She was an amazing lady. They talk about maternal mental health, critical level in Australia. Perinatal anxiety and depression affect 1 in 5 mothers, and that's just in perinatal stage. And there's been a lot of research behind the importance of mum's mental health. And if you could look at your children's mental health, the number one predictor would be the mum's mental health. I can put that research into the show notes. But are you surprised by that, or is that what you see as well?
No, 100%. That's what I see. And that's another part of the reason for this shift towards supporting mums as well, because there's just such a focus on the therapy for the kids, which, as I said, don't get me wrong, like, I 100% support the therapy for the kids, and especially where we're prioritizing what's actually most helpful. And that's obviously different from each child, you know, to the next. But the mums are the ones that are holding so much, carrying so much mental load. And then also the ones that are who are typically most present to be with the kids when they are, you know, overwhelmed and when they're in burnout and when they're having sensory overload, and like the people that need those strategies are typically the mums.
Of course. It's a good point because they talk about the mums being the nucleus of the family. Okay, and you're trying to work with members of the family, but your nucleus is spiraling out of control. What hope do you have to then have a regulated child? Like it would be, if you think about it that way, it's silly that you would not throw resources at the mother, especially one of the reasons this podcast was built. I think for a long time, the slogan was put your oxygen mask on first before others, because it was all about if you've only got, and I mean, such a ridiculous thing to say, if you've only got $3,000, like how stupid, how many people have got $3,000? But if you only had $3,000, I can't believe the words came out of my mouth. I don't believe that money should be spent on one child's diagnosis, no matter the behavior. I think if you're in a neurodivergent family, that $3,000 100% has to go to the mum because of the state of the public health system and the fact that we can't get in. If you've gone through childhood and you've hit 18, the chances of you getting diagnosed with ADHD and medicated as an adult through the public system is like just, I don't see anybody that's done that. Do you?
No, it just doesn't really happen.
Doesn't?
No. You know, I think that's the other part of this is that we're not even talking about mums who haven't been through that journey themselves. Like they're either on that journey, you know, they've just found out, or maybe through kind of, you know, learning about their kids, they're starting to question for themselves, like, oh, that's me, you know, that, like, that happens so often. So the mum is not just holding the space for the children and their diagnosis and their, you know, whole therapy regime and all of that. They're also on a journey themselves of kind of like relearning about who they are, and that can bring also up, you know, a lot of reflection and, oh, that's why it was like that when I was a kid, and that's why that happened. And so mums also need space to be able to process that. And as they unravel that, there's this really nice, you know, like sort of like simultaneous like learning. They're like alongside of each other going on this journey. And so what the mum is learning about is so relevant for what the kids are needing to learn and understand.
But if you look at the transformation, right, like you're given a baby, and the first 5 years of the life, let's say, is tricky. And if you're on this podcast, you would have a child that's being diagnosed with ADHD or something, or you would have had it yourself. So when you're going through that process, if it's after your children have been diagnosed, often you are dealing with a reason that you've gone to the assessment. Then you end up being diagnosed yourself, not necessarily because you put your hand up, but because it's been pointed at you genetically. Mm. And then it's like, just take some time to process that, but also you have no time. And then we're kind of thrust back into this, but then also given a really full appointment list of therapies, which is so unfair if you think about the way that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why so many mums are left scrambling. Like, what do I do? How do I manage all of this? You know, I'm struggling myself to get out the door in the morning and have this time pressure. But now I've got 1, 2, 3 more young children who are likely having very similar struggles, and put that all in together. And as I say so often to mums, like, you've got to give yourself a break. Like, look at what you are managing and dealing with. And no wonder there feels like, you know, it's chaos and there's this overstimulation before 7 a.m. There's so many factors. And that's why, yeah, I have this big focus now on mapping the nervous system, being able to understand like what goes on in my nervous system. And we do that from a place of when everything's like calm and okay. So we've got it when, you know, it's the fan and it's like, okay, let's go back to what's actually going on for me and then what's going on for my kid and what are our needs, because we can't just kind of fly blindly. Like, I think that's the thing, is maybe more traditionally or maybe a neurotypical lens is that like we just do it, you know, and just like, yeah, just do the thing and it all kind of just happens. But we actually have to really plan and consider and treat this like as seriously as it actually is, because it's our everyday lives and it's our quality of life. So yeah, there's like the work there to be done, but then I feel like it's also quite simplistic when we understand it. Like, it's not, because the last thing mums need is another to-do list or another heavy like strategy to implement.
Oh, totally. I've been thinking about doing an identity series this year sometime around people like sprinting towards medication. Like when I found out, oh, I might have ADHD, there's a tablet for this. I was like, give it to me, right? Like I was desperate. Like I need it right now because I've been waiting so long. Now I just need it straight away. And then when we decided to look at medication for my kids, it was the same thing. Once we get the right medication, once we get this sorted. But then once that time came, I still thought it would be like magic because everyone's on the right medication, everything would be fine, and we would all be living happily ever after. But that's really where this episode comes from, because that's not the end of the story. I wish it was, particularly if it was just one tablet and it fixed everybody, air quoting. But that's not how it goes. And this is where some of those natural therapies really come in, isn't it?
Yeah. And, I think that's the thing is, like, it's only natural that we long for some solution that will be a quick fix. There's been a lot of therapy that focuses around the brain and around things like CBT. And if we just change the thoughts and, you know, and we focus heavily on that. But the reality is that there is a state, there is a nervous system state that drives that story. And if we don't work with the state, then we can't change the story because it just doesn't work. It's sort of quite simple in a way because we've got this nervous system here that when we meet it and we map it and then we have our strategies that work to help us regulate back and through that system to where we need to go, then it's like we have a map to our daily life.
Can you give me an example? Because I'm fascinated by that, like in yourself or something that you've seen in a client where it's been more around the nervous system and typical CBT wouldn't work. And CBT, for anyone listening, is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a really old therapy that used to be used a lot more in psychology. And I think there's been a bit of a shift away from it. I can put the research in there. Some people believe it's damaging for neurodivergent people. Some people don't. It's a whole thing. But could you give us an example of something that might not work with CBT or traditional psychology because of the nervous system?
Yeah, well, it's actually in every moment of the day where I can see how it kind of clashes, because let's say hypothetically, like I walked in here today and what happens is you naturally neurocept me and I neurocept you. So it's kind of like this, basically not consciously, but our nervous system goes, is this person safe? Like, is everything okay? Had your nervous system said to you when I walked in, this is unsafe, you've got a couple of possibilities. One is I'm wearing a dress that triggers a memory from back when you're at school and you had that nasty teacher and she had a dress like this, and you go, oh, yeah, okay, so that's about that. Oh, she's actually safe and this is okay. Or there is nothing around that. You're constantly getting this niggling feeling. She just doesn't feel safe. This doesn't feel right. And you ask me to go and I leave. And you find out later that actually there was some reason why I was not a safe person for you to be around. Now, you can try and talk yourself out of that. You can use your brain and be like, oh, no, like, oh, I just need to say something positive right now. Rachel's a really great person. Come on in. And your nervous system's giving you information for a good reason. So when we override that, we're actually challenging that safety, you know, that real core neuroception of what is going on around us. And we need that. It's only when it gets a little off because trauma, because of, you know, previous experiences, we start checking in with it. And sometimes it's like, it's a bit like a smoke alarm and it's going off even though there is no smoke. So we do have to be aware of it. We have to know it, but we don't want to shut it down either. We don't want to just override it because potentially you're just keeping yourself safe and you want to trust that too.
And I'm going to try not to divert, but that's so interesting because a lot of us were taught as kids, like, for example, your jumper's itchy. No, it's not. No, example, come on, we've got to go. And it's like they want to finish their show. Then they struggle with transitions. Everyone just gets up and go, just get up and go. And then there's this overriding of your nervous system that takes place where I feel like if you walked in and I had a feeling of, I don't know about this person, I don't think I want them in my studio alone. Let's just say I did feel like that. I would just say to myself, you're stupid because you're not good with people. And I would let you come in and totally think it was on me to make you feel more comfortable, because clearly I'm the problem. Is that what you're referring to, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And that's what, you know, unfortunately is kind of taught with this messaging that everything is just like, have a positive thought, reframe that, turn that around. But you're going against like what actually is. And sometimes, you know, maybe your nervous system, maybe it isn't that. But again, if we don't have awareness of it and we just want to focus on, say something really positive and make yourself, you know, feel better and kind of always resisting. It's like it's a resistance. So what we resist persists. So we keep resisting it. No, no, no. She's fine. I'll let her in. That's not a problem. But there's something in you that has said, like, this doesn't actually feel safe to have her in here on my own. And we need to be able to trust that. Yeah.
Oh, totally, because that's what we're teaching our children, right? Like I say to my kids, if something doesn't feel right, you know, all the body safety things. But that's so interesting because when you brought that up, I was like, oh, well, I would totally let you in and assume it was my fault, which is the complete opposite to what I'm apparently teaching my children. That's a red flag. I feel like I should revisit a few things with my daughter. But so when I said on Instagram that you were coming on, I mentioned the nervous system that I had an expert coming, and I have a listener question for you that I haven't told you about. So watch me freak out the neurodivergent guest, the listener
Thanks
question
for scaring me.
That she...
This wasn't scary enough. It just got scarier.
Okay. So I had a lot of questions coming in, but I've got one from Maddie on Instagram. And she said, we are a whole family of ADHDers. I was wondering, could you ask Rachel, how can we stop yelling and snapping at each other when we are all at our limit?
Yeah, great question, Maddie. And I just want to say, like, you're not alone. There are so many of us as neurodivergent families that find ourselves in that snappy, yelly stage. And it sort of began so far back, like it's actually coming from so much earlier than that moment. And that's why, as I touched on earlier, you know, I really like to focus on creating a recipe. So I know we talk about spoon theory, you know, for those that are familiar with that. And for those that aren't, it's basically that concept around how much capacity you have and how you are making sure that you're only using the spoons that you have. So that's sort of the beginning of it. But then it needs to go so much deeper into where are we using our energy? What does each person in our family need in a week? And like, I'm talking pretty detailed. For example, I'm working, you know, with a mum at the moment around, how do we map out each child's and the mother in this instance's needs in terms of sensory, in terms of socialization, all of the factors that make their week work or not? Because so many people find themselves in these situations where there's yelling and there's screaming, and it's because everybody's just gone too far past their limit, you know, and it could date back to, like, this might be on Thursday, there's the yelling and the screaming. It might date back to what began on Monday, you know, when you went to swimming lessons after school and that was too much, but then you had to go to that OT appointment after. And then there was the fact that, you know, there's been too much sitting because this child, for example, needs to be able to move their body more and they hadn't, or they need really deep pressure and they haven't been able to get that because we'd been, you know, at the friend's place later that on Wednesday night. And then there's all these things that add up to, again, create that moment. And so it's probably not a simple answer in that I think there's a lot of planning involved in understanding like what the needs are and then implementing that. But once you have that, then you've just got these really like simple go-tos, but things that are just, they become sort of like automated. It's like we don't go beyond our limits wherever possible in a week, and we know what our week looks like. So it's a really personalized schedule, if you like, but it's not a schedule that just goes like, oh, where do I have to be at what time? It says, what do we need? How are we going to meet our sensory needs? How are we going to make sure that people are feeling more regulated so as we're not just flying off the handle? Because once we're in that fight or flight, that's where we go to. And that's the other piece of this is how do we make sure that our family's understanding what happens in our nervous system? And it's about verbalizing it. So, for example, when I'm feeling stressed, I'm feeling like, you know, it's going up, 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 I'm saying like, there's just too many noises for me at the moment, and there's too much this and there's too much that. And sometimes I'm able to say that calmly, and sometimes I'm, you know, on the verge of like yelling that. And that's obviously, again, depending on at what point we're catching this and being able to then flick into the strategy that we know works for us when we're in a fight or flight, or if we're more, you know, tending towards this, like a shutdown, what we call like a dorsal vagal state where we're really just going inward, then we might also be verbalizing about that as much as we can, just to let everyone know where we're at. And then we can do that for our children. I say that with also the caveat around PDA for some kids. That's actually really triggering to have any kind of sense of autonomy lost around someone else saying how they're feeling. So just being mindful of whether that works. You know, again, trusting your own neuroception around, does this work for my kid? No, but it works all right with the other one. And if it's not working for a child where you're sharing, you know, I'm noticing like that you might be feeling really overloaded by all the noise and all of the lights and stuff in here at the moment, like, and can I help you? It's then I'm feeling really overwhelmed by all these bright lights and all of the noise in here. And this is what I'm going to do because I know that helps me. And so you sort of can do it as a parallel without such a direct impact on that sense of autonomy.
Well, that's a great point. One of my kids has always been the way that he doesn't know when he's hungry, but he gets really hangry. Mm. But he also has no idea if he's hungry. So it's like a constant like nervous system whole thing for me because I'm constantly having to monitor him he's under 10, but still he's old enough that he should be able to get a snack, right? Should be able to get a snack if needed, but he's never been out of notice if he's hungry. And he's also a little bit PDA, I think. So if I say to him, I feel like you're hungry and you're getting disruptive or you're getting angry or whatever it is because you're hungry, do you think you might be hungry? He, like, that is a recipe for him not never, ever, ever eating again. But he's very helpful. So if I say, can you go get me some chips? Gee, I really feel like honey soy chicken today because I know that's his favorite. Mm. He will sit next to me and eat the whole bowl. But if you directly ask him, tell him, it's like he's never eating again for hours. It gets worse. That's what you mean, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it might be, you know, like I'm feeling really hangry right now. Like, would you be able to, do you want me to grab us some chips? Or you might just do it, like you said, completely for yourself. Like, I'm going to get some chips. And then you sit down and there's the bowl. And it's that alongside of, and I touch on that because I'm really mindful that for a lot of PDAs, strategies that typically work for autistic children and for ADHDers don't necessarily work. So just making sure that, yeah, you're mindful of who your child is and which one might be the better approach.
It's really tricky because there's so much load on the mums that we've spoken about, right?
Mm.
And there's so much load, I think, on being hypervigilant, which comes from, I believe, a childhood, right? Like scanning, I am praised when I'm a good girl, whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we come into adulthood and we have children. Like two of my kids are quite like, I call them a little bit like a time bomb. You know, you've got to kind of tread lightly because once they go, they go. And because of so many experiences with me having had them in tricky positions, to say the least, for long periods by myself managing, it's like that's quite traumatic when you have had that publicly over and over again. It makes me question going out and doing things right. So when we do that, I feel like I have to scan for all of the things that are possibly going to go wrong, food included, particularly for that one. And two of them have aphid, which is incredibly tricky to feed children with aphid. So at the end of this, that load comes on quite heavily onto the mum. I'm in a relationship with a beautiful man that I love dearly, very lucky in that he's great. He's super supportive. However, sometimes even in the short period of me going to have a shower, he may not understand and his world is not mental health like mine is. And his world is that's not his interest or his passion, but he tries his best. But if I go have a shower, when I come out, there may be chaos because he may have said, particularly to that one child, well, you seem hungry, mate. Like, so why don't we just get some food in? And then there's a storm that's created that I'm then trying to put back in and sort everybody out, particularly with a hubby that doesn't know that he's done anything wrong necessarily because to him he hasn't and he's trying his best. He's actually really, really from where he wants to go and what he would have said 5 years ago, he's doing great. But from where he needs to be with a particularly volatile child, you've got a major mess that then I'm cleaning up. And my thought is I shouldn't have had a shower for so long. And it's really, I try not to make it depressing, but it's really tricky to say the least because it doesn't just feel like it's all on you. It actually is on you a lot of the time. That scanning nervous system then is there all the time because you really have to tread so lightly a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is, I feel, the story for so many mums. Like they are the ones that are carrying this really heavy load and there does tend to be that hypervigilance and kind of, and also like wanting just, yeah, to prevent the meltdown that might happen if
because we're cleaning it up, right?
Exactly.
Like the cleanup is coming on me, right? That's how it feels. Yeah. So then later on, I think to myself, maybe I'm too controlling. I'm not relaxed. Maybe I'm too intense. Maybe I'm this, maybe I'm that. But then on the other side of it, I'm like, there's a lot of past experience that's really pointing to, I don't have an hour and a half of cleanup for a meltdown if I can avoid it. And I know that that's going to be me doing it. So then I really wonder how we can possibly get through this. And I know I'm going off topic, but just because you're talking about the nervous system and the mum load, I'm like, there is some serious problems. And I actually don't know where to start.
Yeah. What I'm about to say, like, actually, it kind of grates me even in saying it, but I do believe that it's true, is alongside of these strategies, alongside of the nervous system regulation, there's also a really valid space for acceptance. And it's a hard one to swallow. Well, personally, I find it a hard one to swallow, and it's something that I'm always working at. But there has to be some level of acceptance for mums to go, you know what? I've done what I can do. I need to have a shower. This isn't going to go well when he says this thing, and I'm going to come out and I'm going to find some serious dysregulation, and that's going to feel like another job. But I don't actually have to pick up every piece that is dropped.
Wow. Well, that is a great answer, isn't it? So can we just play this out, right? So let's just use the shower example, because I reckon that's a really relatable one for people. Let's say you come out and there is a mess, and your hubby's like, well, look, I mean, I just told him that he should have something to eat because he seemed like he was getting really angry. And then that child there is kicking right off. What do you do if you had that acceptance piece? And I don't have it, so I'm not there. But let's just play a game where I did have it. What would I do differently if I had that?
So the first thing is that you're not beating yourself up. It's not your fault. You didn't have too long of a shower. You tended to your own needs. And that's as equally as valid as tending to their needs. So I did what I needed to do. And now this is how it is. And it doesn't feel good. Do I have the capacity right now to be able to do something to help with this? And that might be something that's not necessarily directed at that child or whoever is involved. So I'll give you an example. Actually, a very recent example of way too much overstimulation in my lounge room. You know, kid who's playing the flute alongside of the TV.
Oh, why do you have a flute inside your house?
And it's my own fault. I gifted him that flute that day.
I thought that was just like family members that hated you, give you musical instruments.
I did it to myself. And I do have a habit of doing this. I'm not very good at thinking through to the future, like what that looks like. I just see the flute and think, oh, he would love this flute. Wouldn't it be nice if he played music? Oh, I'll buy this and it'll be a gift from when we're away.
Do you know I go the opposite? Don't you love ADHD is and like whatever our makeup is? It's like you then buy the flute and then it creates a huge issue in the lounge room. Whereas I then go, we are never having musical instruments. Musical instruments do not exist. We can play music on level 10 volume and that's it. And it's like all I do is future play how awful it would be. And so I don't do anything. And you do the opposite.
I'm the opposite. I'm like a 10-second Tom. Like I completely forget that I've been through this kind of trauma before from the last musical instrument that I purchased. Literally.
See, I would be like, what if Rachel and her son bring the flute to my house? I can't have that. So now Rachel is off my list that she didn't ask to be on.
I've moved out of the top three.
Because I'll look for any future-orientated problem and just scrap all of it.
Well, I'm glad you're thinking ahead for us.
I know. And it's like, I still haven't met Rachel and I'm like playing this out. But okay, so you bought the flute.
Yeah.
And he's playing it in the lounge room.
Yeah. So he's playing it. The TV's on. My daughter's doing a strange thing alongside of this where she's got one of those, you know, like a shaver buzzer thing. So it's making like that buzzing sound. And so she's sort of giving Dad a little trim on his hair and what are the other noises? There's some other noises going on as well that
it's always a dog barking or something random like that.
Obviously, yep. I was just too overwhelmed to be able to remember all of the problems. And, you know, I have a bit of a joke like about the big lights. I don't like the big lights on at night.
Oh, yeah, no.
So the big lights have been, you know, flicked on and there's just too much happening. And so I've walked out, all of this is going on, and I tried to just sort of sit, you know, in amongst it for a bit, and I was like, I cannot handle this. And so I thought to myself, okay, what can I do that we move sideways? So I'm not going to come up to the one who's screeching through the flute. I'm not going to just...
It sounds like a nightmare.
Like, this would be my worst case scenario, what you're describing.
This is probably my daily scenario, to be honest. So, yeah, I'm very familiar with it. I wouldn't say I've always handled it this way. So I go and get some candles and the lighter, and who wants to light some candles? And then I just subtly, whilst, you know, they're moving, take that one and that one. The TV goes off. The lights slowly start to go off. The flute magically disappears. And we're lighting candles, and the next thing, the nervous system regulation music just happens to start playing in the background, and everybody's lying down. Or maybe one person still got a fair bit of movement with their candles, right? There's no fire, so that's good stuff. And within 5 minutes, but maybe less, the whole energy had just like come down and dropped, but there was no demand. There was no like, do you want to do this or this? Like, it's just sort of a, it just starts to sort of, in like, I'm lighting a candle. Can I light one? Like, oh, I happen to have 50 here, you know.
I think, because when you're talking about an overstimulation moment like that, it'll be hard, I reckon, to pull my kids away. Lighting candles would actually do it. Mm. That's actually a really great strategy. I reckon that's a cracker, actually, because I actually sticky tape big lights in my house shut. Are they permanently shut? Like, I didn't realize I had any sensory issues until only a few years ago. And then I was like, oh, wow, I actually have major sensory issues, which I'd always just accepted. But that's actually a really good diversion, because you're right, with kids with PDA, if you tell them directly, we're not having music now, we're not having the flute, we're not doing the shaving thing, it's like that's a quick way for them to just keep doing it.
It's going to get louder, the flute will get louder, and it'll come probably up in your ear. You know, there's going to be some level of resistance to that. Yeah, I like the idea of kind of a side thing to whatever's going on when there's
overstimulation or than the one that they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. And it does have to be. And that's what I mean. Like, sometimes, you know, you might try that and you're like, okay, well, that didn't work. What do I know about my kids? What gives them, you know, for example, are they dopamine seekers or what's going to give
them? Yeah. But I suppose then, let's just say if lighting candles was one of your tools as like, let's transition out whatever we're doing. It's like you've got to have a bit of a toolbox, right?
Yeah.
Like more of a 90s R&B dance party person. So yeah. I'll turn the music up. But interestingly enough, if it's my choice, my volume, right, same as kids, right, then I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. But if it's like just some random YouTube or like the flute, like, I lose my shit.
Yeah.
So I'll turn something up right up the top and be like, let's dance to Usher. So you kind of got to have a few tools.
Yes.
But what I found is that if I'm looking for an activity, it can't be dance party with Usher, because that loses novelty, right? So if you do your candles too often, then you've lost your tool.
Yeah. And what you're saying also is, which nervous system state are we in? So what are we regulating to? For example, if there's like a more of a tension and there's like a fighting and, a, you know, that constant bickering.
You're mentioning all of the things I hate the most.
Yeah.
That sensory overload and the bickering.
It just makes you, like, it's sort of, it's hard to explain, isn't it? That feeling that comes in your body when the bickering starts and just won't stop. And so there's a great one for, like, the side avenue of your dance party, for example. Like, at this point, we had heightened energy. Like, there was too much energy. So it's like, oh, how do we, like, bring that down? So we use that, but then we've got bickering or something. We might do, for example, I know there's one type of activity in nature that is either jumping off a rock into, you know, a waterfall or being smashed by waves. I know that my kids will be happy there, that they will actually get along, that there's not going to be any issues. It's only literally, I think there's just that one thing that's kind of like a go-to. So that's another strategy. It might be a different point in time and whether or not you can make it happen. But just knowing like, okay, well, when we've got this, like this is the thing for that. And then, you know, when we need to, if you've got like a flat energy or like a bored energy, you know, like what works for your kids when they're more in a bit of like a dorsal vagal state, you know, which is our more of like our shutdown state where there's that low energy. And it's the same with playlists, like having our playlists for our states so we can kind of help ourselves to shift out of one and into the other just by bringing in a bit of what we need at those points. And that comes back around to why we map our nervous systems and create our nervous system strategies. So we've just got like these go-tos whenever we see people's states. And again, you know, and you touched on it before, we don't always have capacity for this and we don't always have the time to do that. Like if they're bickering and we're on the way out the door and everybody just needs to get to school on time, we don't have time to light the candles and whatever. But when we can, then it's like we're building the cup up. So we've got a little more tolerance for when the time happens that we just got to get to school and everybody out the door.
Because when you're in those moments, let's say the kickoff is happening or the bickering is happening, it's very difficult to, in that moment, think of something that would trump the awful activity that they're doing or the bickering, which is probably they're getting dopamine from or whatever they're doing, right? They're just meeting some kind of need. So you've got to think of something different. Have you got any others? Because I'm kind of keen to know, because I was thinking maybe you could try and share a few others, because I reckon that lighting candle one, I'm going to use that for sure.
Yeah. So I recommend having visuals for this because most ADHDers are not going to remember in the moment, like, oh, what is it that I do when, well, I personally wouldn't. So having visual reminders. But then one of my on-the-go type strategies, so a similar scenario, but you're in the car, you know how like in the car can be just overstimulated.
This whole conversation is traumatizing. I'm everything sorry. That I hate the most. I actually have thrown myself out of the car in the driveway here when the five of us drive around together. I'll say to my husband, stop the car at the end of the driveway. And if he doesn't, because he's over it too, he doesn't want to stop, I'll open the door and get out while it's moving because that's how desperate I am to get out. Like I fully get it. So sorry. Yes, go.
Yeah. So you've described pretty much the scenario. So it's horrible and there's just so much noise. And you also touched on it before, like my daughter's chosen the music, which is really grating me. And I'm thinking about the email that I haven't sent and we're running late to get to the place. And I'm looking at the time and trying desperately to calculate how long that's going to take. And then the other one, there's all this noise and sort of like making these sort of like overstimulating sounds because, you know, this is a thing, right? If you've got a sensory like avoidant and then a sensory seeking person or combinations in the car. Okay, you get the picture. So I say, and to add into the mix, we've got worry in the car. So we've got someone who's quite anxious. And then I say, okay, three things. And it's just like really quick. And they know what this means. Now, there'll be sometimes like, you know, a child that is not going to engage in this. Generally, it's the same one's not going to because that sounds like it's a demand. And it's also mum's stupid strategy, right? And then we've got the other one who's more likely to. And so three things, and I might start off and I go, three things I can see. And it's like, there's the stop sign, that yellow car and the sky. Three things I can hear, the sound of the car, da, 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 and then three things I can feel on my shoe, like touching my foot and then the breeze coming in the window and whatever else. And they're participating in this as well. And it's incredible. Well, for us, I mean, again, everyone has to find what works for them, but how just like an interruption is the thing. And next thing, we're becoming present. And it's effectively a form of mindfulness. So we're kind of bringing ourselves back and seeing where we are and what we're doing right now. And then we're less able, you know, for the anxious people to be thinking about where I'm going and who I'm going to see and what's going to happen and all of those things. I also then am not able to be making all these verbal sounds because I'm participating in this and I've got to focus. And this is the thing is, you know, for ADHD is like, I feel that the brain is just like wants something to do, right? It wants a job. So give it a helpful job because if you don't, it's going to find something else to do.
Yeah, yeah. The psychologist that we see, he talked about the one who struggles with eating or he doesn't know he's hungry and he gets disruptive, right? And he's externalizing. So it's just can be a lot. Mm. And he talked about he's going to find something to do that you probably won't like. So how about you give him something that you do want him to do before he gets like that? Mm. And it is tricky to say the least because you've got to be an unending person of just like jobs, do this next. Yeah. But it does work in that I find that I am less likely to end up telling him off all day, stop doing that, stop doing this. but then you've got to think of things.
Yeah.
But I still think it's better than what I had before.
Mm.
I wish it was just a one-stop, you know, but it doesn't.
Yeah, press this button and it delivers.
Yeah. And then, you know, like tell him to do that and then like he's perfect for the whole day. Like yep. That would be great, wouldn't it?
But yeah, 100%.
It doesn't work like that. But I think there are, that's some really great advice actually. I'll use that in the car particularly. Mm.
And, you know, it's actually really similar to the concept, I think, for ADHD mums. Like if you're experiencing a lot of anxiety because you're often thinking about things and worrying about things, it's the same thing. Like the brain just, it wants something to do. So then redirecting by, you know, again, if we use the nervous system awareness and understanding as an example, if you're focusing on that and you're giving it something to do, it's going to be something that's more helpful to you than the, whether it be the RSD, whether it be the, you know, anxiety or those overthinking things, you know, it's like it just harnesses the energy for something a little more useful.
Actually, a really good point, because you're right. If you're going to be thinking, better that you're thinking something positive than thinking about every single bad thing that could happen this year. And I do that quite often. Mm. I wake up in the morning, 3 o'clock, and I'm like, wow, what can I think of that's the most negative? It's like, you know, your brain just immediately goes.
Yeah.
Like I think this morning it was 3:15 and I woke up and I started to think about the fact that my mum had died like 15 years ago.
Mm.
And I was like, wow. And then I started thinking, I wonder when my mum was 40 and her mum had already passed away, whether she thought about her mum like this. I wonder if I'll die before my, like, when will I? And then I was like, This has become real dark real quick. But if your brain is going to be on, which mine is off and on, how could you replace, like, for example, those negative thoughts that they're not going anywhere? There's nothing positive that can happen from that thought process. What could you replace that with?
Well, there's something that's, you know, whatever this, it can be something really small that's triggered off thought or, you know, brought that around. And then what's gone on, like what, bringing your awareness, like what's actually going on in your body, because that's sort of what it's about. It's about what's happening inside of me. Like, is my stomach in knots or am I like breathing really fast now that I'm thinking about this? And then, you know, what is helpful right now? Like I can see, you know, like, cause you're saying like, I can see that I'm doing this and this is going really negative. So again, like that awareness is such a key, because if you don't know that you're doing that, you're just going to spiral off and continue down there. But you've sort of offered yourself like, again, a sidestep. Okay. This is what I'm doing. What is my like strategy that I use when I do that? And that's going to be different for different people in terms of what they need. You know, do you need to put on headphones and listen to like a mindfulness?
It's coming back to me now. Because I kind of call it like an entree thought. It's like there's an entree that comes out,
yep.
The thought, and it's not that bad, mm-hmm. The entree. But I know that if I eat that, I'm going down the path of a real negative real quick. But it's like that entree that comes out. So I used to listen to Matthew McConaughey. He used to read sleep stories on Calm. And I used to put that in my ears and not do the entree. Mm. But I don't know why I've stopped doing that.
I think we just forget sometimes what our things are that we do. And that's why, as annoying as it feels to say, like, make the visual. We need the menu. Because if we don't have the menu and that entree has, like, you know, come out and we don't know what's on the menu, then we're probably just going to take, you know, whatever comes next.
Totally.
And rather than consciously choosing, going, well, actually, like, I see that for what that is. Thanks for the offer. I'm actually going to choose this.
But don't you love that I've got sleep spray and I've got all these things that my kids can do, but yet I don't have the headphones or any of the things for myself who wake up more than anyone else. But like, and then when you started talking, I have the tool. I had the tool a few years ago. Never occurred to me where that went. Probably my headphones were moved and I never put them back because there's no priority on my own self. That is going to drastically change my life, Rachel, when you get Matthew back out.
Yeah, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. Again, we come back to focus on mums, gives yourself the support and that it doesn't come naturally. We just always focus on the kids and making sure they're okay, but you need your headphones too. And you probably, like you said, need them more than anyone because you'll probably be most likely the one who is awake. And then tomorrow, the next day, you're the one who's going to hold everything. So let's make sure you're all right.
Oh, totally. And my hubby's working tonight. And I thought, This is probably why I woke up thinking I need to have a good sleep because it's only going to be me on tomorrow night. And then now I've got a result where I'm up since 3 a.m. and didn't think
that I might put in that intervention for myself. It's actually really silly when I strip back. I'm like, that is like, if that was my child and they had a really big day, I would never tolerate that failure from myself by not providing what they need. Mm. And it's just like, I'm like, that is silly.
Yeah, but you know what? You've got such a load that you've carried all day that even having the space, the spoons, the capacity, the anything left to think about your own headphones, that's what happens.
Totally. And then I think, oh, I'll make sure I've got them because my best friend who's going through a hard time might call. Put them in my pocket and, you know, that's it. That's done. I've had great sleep for 3 months and I don't call her either.
Yeah.
But that's interesting the way that happens. If there was an ADHD mum listening who was feeling this massively in their body, because I think the last episode we did on sensory overwhelm was one of our biggest hits. I'll put the link into show notes where I had a guest talking about how that feels. If there was one message around this episode that you wanted ADHD mums to hear, what would it be?
Feel like you've got to do all of the things. You know, the reality is that you as a mum of neurodivergent children and as a neurodivergent woman have a load like no other. And there is only so much you can do. So be kind to yourself and, you know, take on board what you can and implement what you can, but also find, work on, try and find some of that level of acceptance that I know is so hard for women who just typically want to do the very best they can all the time. Nothing is ever enough. Want the absolute best for their kids. Or just giving their all. But at some point, we have to find some level of acceptance to say, I've done the best that I can do. I love my kids and that's enough.
You know, something from childhood that still echoes through me, and I'll try and finish it up and not go on a side quest, is that whole thing around trying your best. Because for a undiagnosed autistic ADHD girl, as soon as someone would say, as long as you tried your best. So I am so literal. I thought, oh, I need to do 120% on every single thing, every single day, forever. And then there's this whole thing around just try your best. And it sounds really nice, right? Maybe it was the messaging to my particular brain, but it's been really difficult with that through mum life because I have struggled with that. Just try your best doesn't mean 120%.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Because try your best, that's actually a really nice thing to say. And I say that to my kids. Mm. But then I've been thinking like berating myself because something doesn't go right because I've missed one tiny thing. Like that is so silly at the same time. So I've had to really rethink trying your best. That doesn't mean 120%.
Yeah.
Do you reckon some mums still struggle with that? Because that really gets me still.
Yeah. And I've always sort of interpreted as, well, what is my best? Could it be a little bit, like, should I just,
that's
could it be
I
a
mean.
Little bit more?
That's like, what I mean.
I don't know where that line is because there is no definition of what is my best. And I think that, you know, like, maybe when we, you know, in neurotypical world and where we sort of spent so much of our time like thinking that that's where we are, we come to take on these concepts of like just try a bit harder and all those kind of things. I actually feel for neurodivergent women, my message is we have to learn how to undo a little bit of that because you're actually some of the hardest working, most dedicated women that I have ever known, and you don't need to try a little bit harder. You actually have to learn sort of the opposite.
Oh, yeah. I think mum life for ADHD mums, it's not just that it's harder and yes, executive function, it is, but geez, we hold ourselves to high standards. Holy shit, we do.
Yep.
And it's a recipe for disaster.
And you're right. It's part of the problem that we experience.
But anyway, so I asked you for a final message and I took you on a side quest. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it and I'd love to get you back another time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great to chat.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD mum's shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool
If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.